Welcome back to WBOI Presents. I'm Ben Clemmer.
And I'm Rebecca Green. One practice we've adopted for these roundups is putting a local lens on an issue in the national conversation. This year, we've covered the March for Our Lives and the Women's March. Last year, we looked at the issue of DACA, as well as refugee resettlement. Many of those refugees came from Syria, a country we've all heard a lot about after a chemical attack was followed by U.S. airstrikes there in April.
Antiochian Orthodox Christians came to America a long time ago, but they traced their faith back to communities that did live and still live in Syria. The recent airstrikes were rebuked by the patriarchs of the Antiochian Orthodox Church. There are parishioners at St. John Chrysostom in Fort Wayne who have had their lives impacted by conflict in the country. For this episode of WBOI Presents, we are joined by St. John's pastor, Father Michael Sacrin. Welcome to WBOI Presents.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here, Ben.
We can start out with a little bit of history. What is the Antiochian Orthodox Church?
The Antiochian Orthodox Church is an ancient Christian community. It goes back to the very cradle of Christianity in Greater Syria. You can read in the New Testament that the first followers of Jesus Christ were first called Christians in the city of Antioch. And so that community served as like a springboard for early Christian missionary activity. And the communities never ceased to exist. The faithful have maintained their liturgy and their faith right down to this day, for the most part unchanged. And then in the 19th century, immigrants from the Antiochian church in Antioch came to North America, and they established communities here. And this is what we know now as the Antiochian Orthodox Archdiocese of North America, something like close to 300 parishes and missions. And we're part of the wider family of the Eastern Orthodox churches.
And those 300 parishes all within the United States?
Yeah, those are just the Antiochian churches. There's something like 5 to 6 million total Orthodox. And I don't know what percentage of that we make up, but a good number.
What other Orthodox Christian communities are in Syria?
Quite a few. The Antiochian Orthodox are the largest community there. There's also Melkite Catholics, which is an Eastern rite of the Catholic Church. There's Armenian Christians, there's Syriac Orthodox, Assyrian Christians, so just a good mix. They make up, if I'm not mistaken, close to 2 million people. It's about 11% of the total population in Syria today.
Care to tell our listeners a bit about yourself and your community in Fort Wayne?
Yeah, I've been a priest close to 8 years. Before serving as a priest, I'm a veteran of the United States Marines, so I served in the military, originally from Houston, Texas. My first parish was as an assistant priest in Canada, in Ottawa, Ontario, and then I was there for 4 years, and since 2015, I've been the pastor of St. John's here in Fort Wayne, which is part of the Antiochian Archdiocese. And it's really a kind of a culture of melting pots. I've got people in my parish who are recent immigrants from Syria within the last 30 years, other Middle Eastern countries as well, Lebanon and Palestine. And they brought their children with them, and now their children are having kids in our community. I've got people who are of Middle Eastern and other Orthodox countries descended from them, Macedonians and Greeks, and they've been in the country for 3 or 4 generations now, so they're Americans for all intents and purposes. And I've got just converts from different backgrounds as well. And so, yeah, it represents kind of just a cross-section of society.
Putting a number on it, how many Antiochian Christians in your community are from Syria?
Let's see, I've got about 50 families, and, you know, I've got maybe 10 of those families are from there, and they're all related to each other, and these are all cousins and nephews and aunts and nieces and whatnot. So they make up probably about a third of my congregation.
Has that all been in past decades? How many have come in recent years in the midst of sentiments that are anti-refugee, if not anti-immigrant in general?
Absolutely. I don't have numbers for you. I mean, I know that, you know, when the early 20th century, late 19th century, that's when kind of the influx of the original immigrants came through, and I think it's been kind of sporadic since then. You know, I don't know how many have come to the United States, to be honest with you. I'll give you just an example. One gentleman in my parish, he came over here just before the current war started in Syria. His wife and children were still in Syria, and he was intending to get established here and bring them over a year or two later. It was 8 years before he was able to bring his family over. They just got over here last year. And so I think it's kind of a common experience with some people. When I was in Canada, the policy there was a little bit more open towards immigrants, a more multicultural thing. But, you know, here in America, I think it's been more difficult for them to come over for just various reasons. Yeah.
There's that family connection, to be sure. What is the relationship between Antiochian Christians and the country of Syria today?
they represent not so much a country, but their Christian faith from Syria. But there is still a love of their country. I mean, this is their homeland. And so when I talk to my parishioners, it really breaks their heart to see what's going on over there. As far as relationship with the United States, I mean, this is our country too. This is their adopted country. They live and work here. These are our neighbors. Our kids go to school with their kids, and you know, they're driving on the roads with us. They're involved in the community. And as far as our relationship with kind of on government levels, I mean, I think it amounts to more to just helping the people of America understand their situation, to give our people in Syria a voice. And just to help our high levels of government negotiate peace over there, and we're really trying to kind of push for that.
The context for our conversation today is the recent airstrikes in Syria after a chemical attack. How does the Antiochian Church view Assad?
You know, it's hard to say because we're not on the ground over there. You know, when I talk to my parishioners, I'll be honest, his name doesn't really come up. It doesn't come up. They're more concerned with just peace. I think with the situation in Syria, it's really hard to put a clear cut, okay, this is a bad guy, this is a good guy. It's a very fluid, complex situation over there. So I'm sure there are many that feel protected underneath him, and I'm sure there are some that feel like, you know, an alternative would be a better choice. I don't know what the percentage of each side is, but with my people, at least, it doesn't really come up too much. They're just really pushing for peace under whatever leader can bring that to them.
The patriarchs of the Antiochian Church released a statement after the airstrikes in Syria. They made several points. I'm quoting here. One asserts that the claim the Syrian army is using chemical weapons and that Syria is a country that owns and uses this kind of weapon is unjustified and unsupported by sufficient and clear evidence. Who do you think the patriarchs believe was responsible for the chemical attack, if not the government?
You know, I don't know who they think. I mean, this statement, I think, was just issued in a time of just kind of fear and haste. Just from what I've heard, it seems like maybe they're pointing to the extremists who have done this. Some people are of the mind that it was orchestrated. Now, I don't know. I just don't know. It might have been Assad. It might have been the extremists. I have no idea who they're trying to point fingers to, but I don't think they enumerate that in the letter at all. They don't really point the blame to anybody in particular.
It's more that they point out that there was not sufficient enough evidence to warrant an airstrike. Syria has been the front for years of conflict. What steps do you think need to be taken to stop the fighting in the country?
Peace has existed in Syria before. The Christians and the Muslims lived there in peace up until these recent events happened within the last 10 years or so, for the most part. You know, as far as how peace can be reestablished there, I mean, only God knows at this point. I think kind of the cat's out of the bag. I don't necessarily think that you know, committing to a really deep military action is gonna solve the problem. Because if the U.S. does take Assad out of power, then I think we need to consider what's going to replace him. It could be a situation similar to what happened in Iraq after we left over there and gave rise to extremism, and I don't want to see that happen. I don't think our people want to see that happen. So how that goes about, whether it's through peaceful negotiation, which we prefer, whether it's going to be a military action, I don't know. I'd rather not go to that level, but it may be the case where that's what it's going to take. I'm not the one to say. I don't know. We just pray for peace and hope and try to push for peaceful negotiations as much as we can.
Any other messages for our listeners? NPR has a vast network of foreign correspondents. So as we hear more from Syria, what do you hope people remember when they hear those stories?
What I want them to remember is when we see this conflict going on, it's not just against this faceless dictatorship. I mean, these are people, human beings that are being affected by this. A lot of them are Christians. They're Christians like, people that go to our churches that are involved in our community. And they're like us. They just want to live and work and raise their kids in peace. And they just want to see peace in their country. They're tired of fighting. They're tired of war. They're tired of living in refugee camps. And so I'd like our listeners just to be considerate that there is a human face to the victims of this war, and to hope for peace and to help the refugees if they can, and to do whatever they can just to bring about that close to this really grievous conflict that's happening there.
Father Michael Sacrin, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ben.
We're going to stay on the topic of politics and policy during the first part of our show this hour. Primary elections are coming up, but without a presidential race, the highest office on the ballot is U.S. Senator. Democratic Senator Joe Donnelly is seeking re-election. Three Republicans are seeking their party's nomination to challenge him. To help break down this race, Brian Francisco from the Journal Gazette is with our own Rebecca Green.
I am in the studio today with Brian Francisco. He is the political reporter for the Journal Gazette covering Washington, D.C. I believe your title now is Washington editor.
I just prefer a reporter.
Thank you for coming in to be a part of WBUI Presents. And we're going to talk a little bit today about the Senate primary. You have been covering these three now for a while. And if you could just kind of give us some background on each of them and a little bit if there's anything that distinguishes them at this point.
That's the question that comes up time after time at debates, public appearances, in media interviews. What distinguishes one candidate from the other two? There is very little separation among them on policy issues. There is no separation on them as being Trump supporters, backers in many of their responses to questions. Rather than give their own opinions on issues, they will say, I support whatever the president supports, unless he's against it, and then I'm against it. So they've done very little to differentiate themselves, more so by Mike Braun, who calls himself the outsider in the race, the business owner from Jasper, only served 3 years as a state lawmaker. So he can proudly say that he is not a career politician, that Luke Messer and Todd Rokita are. Rokita, of course, was an 8-year Indiana Secretary of State. He has been in Congress representing a western district in Indiana since 2011. Luke Messer, former state lawmaker from Shelbyville at that time, is a former executive director of the state Republican Party and has represented eastern and southeastern Indiana in Congress since 2013. Braun has tried in his commercials and public appearances to lump Messer and Rokita together as career politicians who are out of touch with the real world and that they are swamp creatures. He calls them swamp brothers. Rokita, for his part, says he's the toughest one of the bunch, that he can air all of his grievances in the primary and will be a tougher candidate against Democratic Senator Joe Donnelly in the fall. Luke Messer really pounds on Donnelly, at least he did early in the campaign. He said it was all about Donnelly. He wasn't going to campaign so much against his primary rivals, but that has changed in recent weeks.
In your reporting for the Journal Gazette, have you been able to suss out any substantial differences between their views apart from who is more Trump-like?
Not really. Mike Braun has said, and ProPublica, the news organization, has looked into this on all members of Congress. You can look at their website and compare congressional voting records. And Messer and Rokita have voted together 95.5% of the time that they've been in Washington. Very little difference. Now, in recent months, the big difference that Messer has tried to hammer home is the fact that Rokita opposed the federal spending legislation that Trump signed. Of course, Rokita points out that while Trump may have signed it, he also criticized it. They're trying to have it both ways. But for the most part, they have voted alike, and Braun has made no statements saying how he would have voted differently from them. Now, they have tried to cast Braun as a lifetime Democrat. He lives in he says, what is a very conservative county in Indiana where local officials tend to be conservative Democrats.
Like Adams County where you have, or Bluffton where you have a mayor who's a Democrat.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Or Decatur.
And so he says, yes, he has voted in Democratic primaries, but that was to have a say in local races. It's just like even here in Allen County. I don't, you know, on my ballot there are two or three contested primaries on the Democratic side this time. Not many more on the Republican side, but a few more. So in Jasper County, it's just the opposite, that you have the contested primaries in, it's not Jasper County, but the city of Jasper. You have a lot of Democratic primary action, and Braun says he's always voted for Republican presidents, governors, senators in the general election.
So basically you have the Senate primary is to the right, and primaries usually are more to the left or to the right of the general election. You have then the winner of this is going to be a person who has been tacking hard right for the duration of this campaign against what was once called a blue dog Democrat in Senator Donnelly. How likely are they to come more to the middle, or do you think they're going to stay on that right path, given President Trump's approval in Indiana and the strength with which he won Indiana?
There's no way they can walk back many of the statements they have made, the Republican candidates, that is, many of the statements they have made in debates, interviews, TV ads. Everyone has the image of Rokita wearing the Make America Great Again hat. So they're pretty much stuck in that lane. Now, they can do what happened 6 years ago when Senator Donnelly was elected after Richard Murdoch went far, far right in unseating Senator Lugar, who had been in the Senate for 36 years, helped by that whole Tea Party movement at the time. Senator Donnelly and others will tell you that Murdoch was having trouble throughout that whole fall. And part of it was because of his attacks on Lugar in the spring and then trying to moderate that style. And so this year we're going to have something similar, that whoever comes out of this Republican field, and right now it's anybody's guess who might win, is going to have to attract moderate Republicans and independents to be able to defeat Donnelly in the fall. Donnelly is, by all accounts, one of the three most conservative Democrats in the Senate. He has voted with Trump, depending on what time frame you use, between 55% and 62% of the time. He has voted for many of Trump's nominees for cabinet positions. So it's going to be hard for them, as they have in the primary, to try to paint Donnelly as an Elizabeth Warren, Nancy Pelosi, Hillary Clinton Democrat, because the numbers just aren't going to support it.
Given some of the issues with President Trump, his popularity is not very high, though it's pretty steady here in the state of Indiana. Does Donnelly have a chance to keep his seat at this point, or do we need to wait and see more, kind of how the summer goes, and see what happens with some of the pots simmering on the stove with regards to investigations and some self-inflicted wounds by this administration?
I was watching a newscast today on MSNBC in which they said the best thing to happen to Senators Donnelly, Joe Manchin in West Virginia, Claire McCaskill in Missouri, was Trump winning in 2016. Because had Hillary Clinton won, they would have faced a midterm election in which they would have to defend Hillary Clinton, and they don't have to do that now. Instead, Rokita, Messer, or Braun is going to have to defend, as they've been more than happy to, Trump throughout the summer. Midterm elections historically favor the party that does not control the White House. Going into this year, there was a lot of optimism among Democrats that they could retake control of the U.S. House. Part of that belief was because so many Republicans were not seeking re-election. I think the number is up around 30 by now. And a lot of those are districts that Clinton won in the 2016 election. And the Senate, in the meantime, they thought it was going to be hard for Democrats to take control of the Senate. But a lot of that thinking was that people like Donnelly, McCaskill, Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota had no way of winning re-election. And a lot of that thinking has changed. Those are now considered toss-up seats. And while they may be some of the best options for Republicans to get victories, Republicans also suddenly have states like Arizona that are on the verge of becoming toss-up states, where the incumbent is not seeking re-election. So Donnelly is probably, it's going to be precarious, but I think that with an anti-Trump wave, and according to polling by Morning Consult, Trump's favorability in Indiana, his approval rating in Indiana, is only one percentage point ahead of his disapproval rate. And that's gone down significantly since the 2016 election. So there is going to be a strong headwind against Trump's party in this election. And Donnelly will have that going for him.
Thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to come to the station and talk to us here at WBOI. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Rebecca.
Rebecca will be in the studio on May 8th as results come in from the primary election. Rebecca, what will we be looking for this primary season?
Well, we have, as we just heard from Brian, the contested Republican primary to challenge Joe Donnelly for the U.S. Senate seat. We also have a contested Democratic primary to take on U.S. Representative Jim Banks. Indiana primaries tend to often be a place where some of the more serious races are held. And so we have a number of local sheriff's races and township trustees races that are drawing a lot of attention in their respective counties.
I know I'll be on assignment on Election Day. Where else will our WBOI news team have a presence?
We will be sending Zach and Araceli out to the various headquarters for the Republican Party and for the Democrats. So Zach is going to be spending the evening with the GOP, and Araceli will be at the Dem headquarters down on the south side.
And you will also be in the studio with a special guest for the election process. Now is as good a time as any to tell our audience who will be with us on the 8th.
We're going to have Andy Downs with us. For our listeners, many of you know Andy. He is probably one of the smartest people with regards to Indiana politics. He's the head of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at Purdue Fort Wayne. And we'll be sharing him not just with our listeners here, but with other listeners throughout the state as he talks a little bit about what we see coming in and what the impact will be.
Coming up, we'll be joined by Zach Bernard to discuss what momentum remains in the anti-gun violence movement after the shooting in Parkland, Florida. And so much more. Zach has had a busy month. Stay tuned!